This is the season of relationships, Valentine's Day, the women's brunch is talking about marriage and singleness, and of course, since the topic of tonight is sexuality, we cannot not mention the recent movie 50 Shades of Grey, which just came out. And I want to say something interesting about this movie. It's been interesting. I don't know if you guys have noticed all the chatter that's happened around this movie. If you're not familiar, this movie is about a rich man who is sexually violent and kind of seduces slash accosts a younger woman, and they have this kind of sexual relationship that is not particularly healthy, from what I understand of the movie. But it's an interesting movie because it's been fabulously popular. The book was incredibly popular, and yet it's also been incredibly criticized. And if you've been on Facebook, you've seen all these articles about how terrible it is and what a horrible example of sexual relationship this is, and how we ought not to listen to this story, and yet everybody's going to watch it. It's apparently the movie was the fourth largest movie opening ever of an R-rated movie. So this has made a big splash. And this is an interesting thing, that there is both attraction to this sexual story that the movie tells, but also criticism of it. And that kind of introduces the ideas we're thinking about tonight, because we're thinking about sexuality, about sexual behavior, but also how we talk about it and what we think about it and how we establish standards and how we are critical of standards, but yet people are still flocking to see something, probably some of the same people that are criticizing it. So I'm going to start off with a little whiteboard exercise. So you know I love whiteboards. So we're going to ask two questions. First question is, what have you heard about sex from the culture around us? What messages have you heard? Ready, go. Casual. So this is culture. Sex is casual. What else?
Accessible.
What else?
I want to say easy.
Easy?
Self-gratification.
Measure of success.
Measure of success. Yeah, good. Keep it coming.
Fun.
Doesn't hurt anybody else?
Identity.
Yeah.
Fundamental to identity.
It's a goal.
What's that?
It's a goal.
It's a goal.
Like life can't be good without it?
Okay, it's a pretty good list. So this is what the culture has said about sex. For those of you that have spent time in a Christian setting, at church or in fellowship groups or Sunday school, what have you heard the church or various Christian institutions say about sex?
No.
What?
No.
Nothing? Okay, radio silence. What?
Not
till marriage.
Dirty.
Dirty. Beautiful.
Highly regulated.
Good. What else?
Sacred.
Sacred. What's that?
Destructive.
Mechanism of procreation. Mechanism.
I think I saw Valentine's Day card with that phrase. That's really romantic. Mechanism of procreation. Yeah.
Tempting.
Part of the three
keys
that they usually
say is appropriation, pleasure, and
protection. Wow. Yeah. Like that's God's intention.
Protection
for your spouse to be sexually tempted from to desire sexual gratification from an external source to protect your relationship together.
I feel like there's a lot of emphasis on suppression or like ignoring anything. Okay, one or two more? Anything else?
Immoral in most cases.
Immoral. Last one?
Oneness.
Cool. All right, so the moral of the story is that we are told a lot of things by the culture and by the church. And I think what I want to suggest is that there's a lot of voices telling us different things. Some of those are helpful. Some of them aren't. It's probably not. It's not as simple to say that this side is unhelpful and that side is helpful. So I wish you could say that everything you've ever heard from a Christian setting about sex is helpful and true and right. But that's probably not the case. I think Christians sometimes have some issues with sex and don't know how to figure it out because of some of the ways that sex is twisted. Kind of there's a fear of it, or there's kind of an inability to properly handle it. So hopefully I will add to the unhelpful list of stuff you've heard from a Christian perspective tonight. No, we'll do our best to look at this passage. We're looking at 1 Corinthians 5, 1-13. And the unique aspect of this passage is that it not only deals with sex and sexual behavior, but it is addressed to a community. And the issues it raises are issues of how the community ought to respond to sexuality and how the community ought to think about it together. And so this, for us, this is helpful. We are a Christian community. And so it'll be helpful for us to see what role does sexuality play in our lives and in our life together as a community. The Bible does give a lot of guidance about sexuality. I've experienced this radio silence as well, but the Bible is not silent about it at all. There's erotic poetry about sexuality. There's practical instructions. There's restrictions. There's kind of the whole gamut of stuff within the Bible. And so we're going to try and figure some of that out tonight. I think that in my experience, kind of from a Christian perspective, the Christian message of sex has been before marriage, don't. After marriage, do, right? That's kind of the extent of the instruction that I've heard. And yet, in my experience, before marriage, not having sex is more difficult than simply saying don't. And after marriage, having sex is more complicated than just saying do. And so part of what I'm hoping for is that this begins a conversation where we can talk about this more, that this is a topic that is part of the community, because I think that's what this passage really helps us to see. We're going to be on this topic for a while, for the next several weeks or so. We'll talk about sexuality in the community tonight. Next week, we're going to look at more of a focus on how we as individuals manage sexuality and express our sexuality. We'll be talking about marriage. We'll be talking about singleness. We'll have a few panels over the next several weeks. So we'll be on this topic kind of for the next 5 to 6 weeks. I think that's all I wanted to say for intro, but for now, we're in 1 Corinthians 5, and I'm going to start off just by reading the whole passage, kind of getting it before us, and then I'm going to be highlighting a few key verses that we'll be looking at. So let's read this together. 1 Corinthians 5, 1 to 13. It is actually reported that there is sexual immorality among you, and of a kind that is not tolerated even among pagans, for a man has his father's wife. And you are arrogant. Ought you not rather to mourn? Let him who has done this be removed from among you. For though absent in body, I am present in spirit, and as if present, I have already pronounced judgment on the one who did such a thing. When you are assembled in the name of the Lord Jesus, and my spirit is present, with the power of our Lord Jesus, you are to deliver this man to Satan for the destruction of the flesh, so that his spirit may be saved in the day of the Lord. Your boasting is not good. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? Cleanse out the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, as you really are unleavened. For Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed. Let us therefore celebrate the festival, not with the old leaven, the leaven of malice and evil, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. I wrote to you in my letter not to associate with sexually immoral people, not at all meaning the sexually immoral of this world, or the greedy and swindlers or idolaters, since then you would need to go out of the world. But now I'm writing to you not to associate with anyone who bears the name of brother, if he is guilty of sexual immorality or greed, or is an idolater, reviler, drunkard, or swindler, not even to eat with such a one. For what have I to do with judging outsiders? Is it not those inside the church whom you are to judge? God judges those outside. Purge the evil person from among you. All right, so it's all pretty clear, right? Not too much to say. This is a big, thick passage. There's a lot going on. There's a lot of imagery. There's this imagery of the leaven. There's judgment. There's purging people. There's the world. There's a lot of different things. So we're not going to be able to grasp the whole bit of what's going on. But I want to highlight a few things. Passage starts off with this statement. There is sexual immorality among you. Now, I want us to think about this statement to start, because this statement in and of itself is pretty interesting. The statement implies, first of all, that there is some sexual ethic that this community among you ought to embrace, and yet they are not embracing it. So the whole concept of sexual immorality implies that there is some standard that's not being lived up to. And Paul is criticizing this community for allowing this to take place. And I think it's helpful to realize that all communities have sexual ethics. I think sometimes we feel like as Christians that we're the only ones that care about how you express sexuality, and everybody else just does kind of whatever they want. But that's actually not the case if we think about it. So think back to college, if you were part of kind of a residential college system where people interacted a lot. What sexual ethics did people have, not necessarily Christians, in college? What were some of the ethics people practiced or talked about?
Hooking up.
So was hooking up okay? Okay, so hooking up was included. What else?
Yeah.
Okay, safe. So sex ought to be practiced safely. And by that, they meant birth control, condoms, something like that. David?
No rape.
No rape. Okay, so consent was important, right? Okay, yeah.
I don't know. This is kind of different from everybody else's thing, but
community talked about like no, like dorm sex was looked down upon.
Okay. Okay. So sexual relations among kind of a closed community was frowned upon. Okay. Anything else? Okay. So it's promoted as it's recreation almost.
Yeah, in a weird way. Yeah.
In a weird way. Yeah, so the point of that then is that there are some guidelines, right? The Christians are not the only ones who say sex ought to be this and ought not to be that. The question then is, what are those guidelines and what behaviors fall into which category? My experience in college, one of my friends, I lived with a large group of guys that were all non-Christians, and one of them had this kind of running joke that he was saving himself for marriage. And so this was kind of his sarcastic joke, and he would say it, and everybody would laugh, and it was this kind of really, really funny thing. And so the sexual ethic of that community was that saving yourself for marriage was a stupid idea, right? Arcane and archaic. There's no merit in it. And yet there were some people that also were fairly indiscriminate about their sexual activity and hooked up a lot. And that same community would criticize them and say, you know, they're just players. They're just sleeping around. So there's this ethic of like saving yourself for marriage is stupid, but being too casual was also criticized. So there was this recognition that sex was something that was somewhat significant, and yet there were different understandings of how it ought to be practiced. I think if we were to generalize our culture, there's probably two guiding ethics, and we talked about them. Both of them were mentioned, but they're probably two guiding ethics that guide most of what our culture teaches about sexuality, and that is, one, that mutual consent is kind of the guideline, right? If two people both consent to a behavior, then it's okay. Two people, now that's not quite true yet of ages, right? Consensual sex between somebody who's over 18 and under 18 is not yet okay. And yet, in most cases, mutual consent defines what's okay. And then the second thing that's talked about a lot is protect yourself from consequences, right? And by consequences, what's meant is typically pregnancy or disease or stuff like that. So if it's safe and if there's consent, those are kind of the boundaries. Within that, everything's embraced. Saying that, though, different families, different neighborhoods, different subcultures have variations of those ethics. And so what we want to think about then tonight is if Paul says here, there is sexual immorality among you, and then he says, of a kind that is not even practiced among the pagans. So you're violating an ethic that even the pagans would adhere to. So the question then is, what is the sexual ethic that ought to guide Christian behavior? And there's a lot of aspects to this, and this is probably not a surprise, but the kind of general sexual ethic that I think most Christians would embrace is that sex is meant to be enjoyed within a monogamous heterosexual marriage. Sex is meant to be enjoyed, so there's some embracing of the positive value of sex within, so then there's some restraining constraints placed upon sex, a monogamous heterosexual marriage. Now, there's a lot of aspects to that definition, right? And there's a lot of side trails that we could get off on. But, you know, we could talk about same-sex issues and why some Christians argue that's outside Christian ethics. We could talk about marriage and what's the big deal about marriage. For now, we're not going to go into the details of all of that. But we want to kind of establish that as the standard. So I'm suggesting that is the standard that the Bible presents. And I also want to suggest that we tend to have the capability to rationalize various aspects of that standard, right? And that even in the Christian cultures, we're not great at adhering to various parts of this. Maybe we go the direction of calling sex dirty, or it's always destructive, or it's immoral in almost all cases. Can we go too far on that side, or we go too far on the restrictive side, or we Or we kind of talk ourselves out of, well, you know, we're in love, that's okay. Or in this case, it's okay. We were teaching in India several years ago, and we were teaching on a passage that said, a man must have only one wife. And to us, that was like, oh, you know, I mean, everybody thinks that, right? But in India, that's not the case. And so we taught this, and we had pastors that were raising their hands, and they were going, so, you know, you said that a man might have only one wife, but what if his secretary, her husband died, and she's destitute, and the only way she's going to make it is if she is also married to me. Is that okay? And we're like, no. A man must only have one wife. And it's like, oh, okay, thanks. And then somebody else raised her hand. Well, you said that, but what if this happens, and there's this other woman, and she's really in a desperate situation, and there's love, and but I'm already married, but would that be okay? And we're like, no. It's this. And I think that was indicative of this reality that we can tend to kind of rationalize things away. We can hear one thing and we go, but in this case, surely that doesn't mean this. And yet, really, it does. Now, before we go on and talk about how this ethic gets practiced, I want to also acknowledge that we're talking about a goal here. We're talking about a lifestyle. And you can't talk about this apart from talking about the fact that people have not met this goal, that there is forgiveness, that the question we're asking now, tonight, is starting now, how ought we to think about this? The goal is not at all to say, if you have not lived up to this standard in any way, you ought to feel ashamed or you ought to feel guilty. In Jesus, there is no condemnation. There is no shame. So the point is not at all to say, you're a terrible person if this hasn't been true of you. The point is to say, what could my life look like? The title of the series is The New Life. Even in this passage, there's this mention of live the new lump. You know, you remember that phrase? I thought about titling the series The New Lump, but I thought The New Life had a little better ring to it. But there's this idea of newness. And so what could life in Christ look like? That's the question we're asking. So what do you think of when you hear the word chastity?
Belt.
Yeah, just kind of a word of the wise. If you do a Google image search for chastity, there's some weird things that come up. So you might not want to do that. Learn that the hard way. Anything else? Belts? Nothing else?
How about a nun?
A nun. Anything else? Nuns and belts. Here's a painting that's supposed to represent chastity. All right? Let's see what we think of this.
They can't get to her.
Yeah, the woman, she's protected by these towers. I'm not sure if that's snow or poison on the top of the tower. These lions, I'm not sure what these things are. I think they're like shields or Bible covers or. Yeah, but the lions are out to get her. They're to steal her sexuality, right? And yet she is protected by these mountains. And they look mean, don't they? Although the one on the right is kind of funny looking. So, what I want to try and do tonight, I know this is a really weird word, chastity, but I want to try and redeem this word a little bit. And I want to suggest that the Christian sexual ethic is not a matter of state. It's not a matter of being a virgin or being kind of not sexually active, but the Christian sexual ethic is a process. It is a lifestyle. It is a commitment. It is more akin to a spiritual discipline than a state. And I think sometimes the church, especially in kind of younger groups and various settings, has held up kind of virginity as this standard for the Christian sexual ethic. And then it's like, oh, well, if that's gone, then everything's gone. And yet really what we want to think about is, what does it look like as humans that are in bodies that are sexual to follow Jesus? And what choices do we make in our lifestyle ongoing to do that? And so I want to suggest that chastity could be a word that could be used to mean something other than belts and nuns, and could be guiding, because chastity is something you choose daily, over and over again. And chastity, by the way, does not actually, it's not synonymous with abstinence. Chastity simply means to be sexually pure, to be sexually ethical, to live according to a standard. And so if we follow the Christian sexual ethic, then in singleness, chastity equals abstinence. And in marriage, chastity equals sexual faithfulness, right? And so regardless of your state, single or married, you ought to live a life of chastity. And in both states, there are temptations and there are difficulties and there are complications. And yet this spiritual discipline that's cultivated in our lives is something that carries us through, and it's something that we attain to daily throughout our lives. I find that personally a lot more attractive than this idea of like, okay, the only thing I need to know about sex is don't do it before I get married, but then when I get married, it's okay. Oh, and I guess I'm not supposed to sleep with anybody except my spouse. There's that too. But like, other than that, I just don't, then I do. But this idea of chastity, of something that is part of me, that is something I commit to, that I live out in my life forever, for my whole life, is helpful. I think it's helpful partly because if we think of it as a spiritual discipline, part of the purpose is not just because we ought not to do this or this behavior is wrong, but that this lifestyle actually helps us in some way to know God better. That there's something connecting, whether you're a single who's choosing not to be sexually active, or whether you're married and you're choosing to be sexually faithful in a mature and loving way. Whatever choices you're making, those are choices that are difficult. You're giving up certain things. You're sacrificing your own needs. You're waiting. You're learning to relate to another person. All of those things are part of what it means to learn to know God and to learn to love other people. I think for me, I think I felt kind of growing up as a Christian that most of the sexual advice I received was for when I was single. And then when I was married, it's like, all right, now you can do it. You're on your own. And I have found that sex is more complicated than that as a married person. And so I have wished that there were more instruction, there were more theology, there was more reflection on what's going on and how you walk through some of the challenges that arise within sexuality in marriage. And yet I think we're lacking in that as a church, and I wish we weren't. I want to introduce you to a book. This is a book called Real Sex, and this is kind of where I got the term chastity. It's by a woman named Lauren Winner. The subtitle is The Naked Truth About Chastity. And this, I think, is one of the more helpful books I've read about sex. We read it in our intern program here with the college interns that we hire for the summer. And I think what she does well is really discuss this as an ongoing lifestyle that sometimes has failures, sometimes has successes. And yet the point is to kind of develop this lifestyle of discipline rather than the point is to achieve some state and hold it forever. She's very honest. She's very real. She has her own experiences. I think she writes this when she was engaged at the time, which is kind of an interesting state. But I'd recommend this book. She, in particular, I wanted to read the title of this chapter, Chastity as Spiritual Discipline, Conforming Your Body to the Ark of the Gospel. And I like that idea, that this lifestyle of the Christian sexual ethic conforms us as people who live in bodies to what God has done in the world through Jesus. So, this is what it means then. There is immorality among you. I want to point out real quickly that in the middle of this passage, Paul says, for Christ our Passover lamb has been sacrificed. And what he's doing there is he's returning back to the Exodus story, and he's saying this new life, this choice that you can choose as a Christian to live sexually, is actually a choice of freedom. I don't think we perceive it that way. It goes back to the freedom from bondage out of Israel, or out of Egypt, that God's people were in. And he says, that's what it means to choose chastity, to choose this type of sexual morality. And I don't know about you guys, but I had never felt it that way. It's always felt like restrictive. What was this? Highly regulated, right? So that's what it had felt like to me. And yet Paul says, no, it's actually freedom from something else. And we'll talk more about that next week, because next week the passage says essentially that we are more than sexual appetites. We are more than simply controlled by these desires. There's something more going on there. And we'll talk about what it is that we're free from. So this is the ongoing lifestyle of sexual ethics within the community. We're running a little bit behind, but the question then is, what does it mean for us? If this is what we are to live individually, how do we interact with it as a community? And the passage that we're looking at has all of these phrases that are reminiscent of being in a community. Among you is repeated several times. He says that he criticizes that not only are these people engaging in sexually immoral behavior, a man has his father's wife, but the real criticism of the passage is not for them, but it's for the community that is endorsing it. And so the passage is not written to the people that are engaging in sexually immoral behavior. It's not telling them, stop doing this. It's written to a community to say, you ought to come around this situation. You ought to respond to it differently. It says, you're arrogant. Your boasting is not good. And he uses this phrase, a little leaven leavens the whole lump, which is a lot of L's, right? But the point of this idea is that sexual attitudes, ideas, opinions about sex spread in a community. Sexual norms, what we think is okay and not okay, starts to kind of be assumed as normal, no matter where you are. We are living in a culture where there has been a lot of change in how sex is regarded. I want to introduce you to another book that talks particularly about kind of how our culture has changed. It's called Sex and the I World. And this is a little more of a theological, kind of abstract book about sexuality. But this author suggests that with the advent of the sexual revolution, with reliable birth control, with everything that's happened in the past generation, our culture has completely changed the way sex fits into daily lives. So these questions about politics and about behavior are actually rooted in how we think about sex in general, not just about the behaviors and the laws and stuff like that. He suggests that our basic understanding, the basic goal, is to maximize my own freedom, as long as it doesn't infringe on somebody else's freedom. Okay? That's kind of what we're told as a culture, that my goal is to live and do whatever I want, as long as I don't hurt someone else. That's really the only guideline. And so sex is an element of personal fulfillment. It's about me being fulfilled, that's governed by consent, rather than seeing sex as an act of relational connection that's governed by covenant. So these are big ideas. I can tell you guys are kind of like, wow, that's a lot. That's some heavy stuff. But I just say that to kind of recommend this book, that it's got some interesting ideas. So the reality is that we live in a world that is telling us that the air we breathe has certain messages about who we are, about what we ought to live, about whether we're entitled to sexuality, about whether it's fundamental to who we are, that life can't be good without it. All these are the things that we just assume and that are just constantly fed to us. But there are consequences of that. And I think I have been susceptible to this idea. I don't know if you guys have ever felt this, but if you've grown up in a Christian setting, you feel like, if I could just live the way the world does, it'd be a whole lot more fun, right? If I could just be free of these sexual restrictions, life would be better. I'd be happier. I would enjoy things more. I think I've kind of struggled with believing that for a lot of my life, and still do to some extent. But it's a funny thing to believe, because if you look around at the world, if you look around at people that aren't Christians, they're actually not particularly happy, right? I mean, throwing off the kind of Christian sexual restrictions that are there does not mean, oh, sex is great and it's perfect. I mean, people cheat on each other, they're hurt, they're devastated, they're frustrated, they're lonely, they're all of these things are still there. It's not, there's not actually evidence to support the idea that living by a Christian sexual standard restricts your enjoyment of life. That doesn't bear itself out if you look around. In fact, what this guy suggests is that because of the way we view sex, there's two qualities that particularly result. He says this: if individual freedom is the goal and the means of achieving this freedom is replacing relationships of obligation and responsibility with a world of relational choice, then loneliness and insecurity will result. He suggests that loneliness and insecurity are the kind of sicknesses that result from the way that we view relationships and sex. There's a perpetual haze of relational insecurity that lingers in the I world. That's his word for the kind of contemporary society that we live in. There's also the ever-present nagging question, how will I ever know if I might be happier with someone other than the one I'm with? And if that's true, if sex is just about personal fulfillment, if it's just about me, then why am I going to commit to one person? And how do I know if that person's really going to give me the most fulfillment that I can get? So all of this then means, if this is what we live in, then we as a community of people who are investigating or trying to follow Jesus ought to live differently. There ought to be something different about us. And this is where Paul ends this passage. He has this interesting phrase: is it not those inside the church whom you are to judge? Is it not those inside the church whom you are to judge? So I was thinking for our next YAF t-shirt, we could say like YAF, and we could say like, come here, we judge you. You know? Because, I mean, that's what this says, right? Like, we're a community that judges each other. Come be a part of us, right? I think it'd be fabulously popular, don't you? We don't like the idea of judgment. I mean, and you might say, well, somewhere else Jesus says, judge not, lest you be judged, right? I mean, aren't we not supposed to judge? Like, isn't that kind of a big part of what it means to be Christian? And yet here Paul says, aren't you supposed to judge those inside the church? Well, what does that mean? I think it means that we can't change the world. The call of God's people is not to be sexual reformers in general society. We're not meant to go out and to change everybody's behavior and to kind of stamp our version of what sexual morality looks like everywhere we go. I think the church has tried to do that in the past, and it's been damaging to the world and to our reputation. But what I think he's saying is that we live out our sexuality in the midst of a community. And here's one of the most challenging ideas about this passage: your sexuality is not just your business. It doesn't just belong to you. Now, let's quickly add some caveats. That doesn't mean we go around, hey, you know, how's your sex life? What's going on? It doesn't mean that it's everybody's business. It doesn't mean that there's no sense of privacy. There is a sense of kind of, this is something that I choose to share when I choose to share it. But it does mean that it's not just about you, that the choices you make affect a community, and the community in the right context has the right and the responsibility even to speak into that. I think it's probably most helpful when that happens by way of us sharing with each other our struggles and our joys and our failures and what is difficult, rather than us kind of saying, hey, this, you know, rather than me saying this is your struggle, I can share my struggle. I can say, this is what it looks like for me. This is what I'm having a hard time with. This is what I don't understand. This is where I'm getting tripped up. And I need help. And where that happens, when you get in a community of people, and it's usually a smaller group, it's often a group of same-gendered people, but when you get in that type of community and you're able to say, this is what I'm struggling with, this is what's going on, there is an incredible amount of freedom. It's an incredible amount of healing, of support that can happen. Because apart from that, there's kind of the Facebook fallacy, right? That like, everybody's always happy because their Facebook pictures are always of them smiling, right? And if you're single, then like you're just like super Christian, totally pure, never have a sexual thought, and you're just like, abstinence is great, I love it, right? Because you never talk about it, so of course you're like loving abstinence. It's the best thing ever. And that's what you think. Like all the single people are just thinking this is great, and all the married people are having great sex all the time, and there's never any complications, and that's what we think if we don't talk about it, right? But when you talk about it, when you start to share, you realize that whatever is out there is in here. Whatever's going on, there's pornography, there's masturbation, there's prostitution, there's adultery, there's abuse, there's premarital sex, there's fantasies, there's casual sex, there's sexting, there's the whole gamut. I mean, nothing surprises me anymore that we're all broken and we all struggle with stuff. And one of the values of being in a community where you're able to bring your experience to it is that paralyzing fear of, I'm the only one that's done this, is gone. Because you hear, oh, I'm not the only one. I'm not the only one that struggles with this. Somebody else does. And you're able to bring that to a place, and maybe it's not exactly the same thing, but you're able to come and say, this is where I'm at, and this is, I want to live this way, I want to commit myself to this lifestyle, and yet it's difficult for these reasons, and for this is what's going on. And that's an incredibly beautiful thing when that happens. So my encouragement for us is kind of twofold tonight. First of all, is to think about this. What does it look like to live a lifestyle of chastity? And replace that word if all you can think about is belts and nuns. But what does it look like to choose a commitment to living out your sexuality in a way that is consistent, whether you're single or married or divorced or widowed or whatever, but that you kind of have a mentality of following Jesus means living this way with my body, and that's a commitment. And then what does it look like to do that in the context of other people and to share with them? And to connect and to be honest and to listen to someone else and to receive encouragement and forgiveness, to have that shame broken down. There are some great things going on in that area. We're going to hear next week from some people sharing about stuff that they've experienced in that manner that's been really freeing, and that's going to be a treat to hear. There is talk of starting a ministry particularly aimed at men at PBC that are dealing with sexual issues. That's kind of been ramping up, and there'll be some events kicking off in the next several weeks or months here at the church, so that's really encouraging. But when you're able to do that, that's when powerful stuff happens. So we're going to spend some time discussing this, maybe about 20 minutes till about 9:15. Big ideas here are that there is this guideline that we have, that the Bible does give us a discipline, a lifestyle to shoot for. That we live in a world that gives us all sorts of other messages, all sorts of things that are supremely unhelpful. And yet, we're also part of a community where we can strive together with honesty and forgiveness and openness to live a certain way. So the question I want to kind of leave you with is, who knows what's going on with you in terms of your sexuality? Who knows? And if you're married, other than your spouse. Because if the answer is, well, nobody knows. That's just me. And I haven't talked to anybody about it. And I don't want to talk to anybody about it because it's my business. Then I would challenge that and say, who could you talk to? Who could you invite into that discussion? And that's a scary thing, and it's risky, and it's vulnerable. But in my experience, it's really worthwhile. So let me pray, and then we will break up into our groups.